Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I am your host for this week, Ben Hallam. Summer is almost certainly upon the Twin Cities as temperatures are reaching up into the 80s, the sky is a gorgeous blue, and you're free to do whatever you would like outside. But that raises the question, what exactly is there to do in the summer? It can be easy to forget during the long Minnesota winter what exactly summer's like and what exactly we're supposed to do during this hot weather. Well, wonder no more, because the Real College Podcast has put together this episode about summer activities in the Twin Cities, ranging from do-it-yourself beekeeping, to cycling, to taking a ride on a Minnesota steamboat. Here's RCP reporter Jackie Renzetti with more.
When you think of the Twin Cities, you probably picture the skyline and all of the urban energy that comes along with it, but we also have our very own national park in the Mississippi River. Multiple times a week, a riverboat called the Minneapolis Queen immerses passengers in one of the city's hidden gems.
You see boats like on the river, but you never like think like, wow, I want to be on that boat, you know? But once you're out here, you have a great time and you definitely want to come on here.
That was Ben Bookie, a University of Minnesota student who's working on the boat this summer. He says customers climb aboard for various reasons, from weddings to corporate events to public tours. For some, the riverboat provides a place of refuge and a reminder of natural beauty in the middle of the work week.
I hate the cities. This is what I would do all day, every day if I could be out on the water. I mean, who wants to drive a car on a freeway with millions of other cars? I'd rather be out here on the water, and it's so much prettier. You see so much more when you're not in a car.
Other passengers came to bond with family and friends. Frank Noel came with a group he calls Last Man Standing.
We are a group of people who went to St. John's Prep School and graduated in 1958. And we have a group called the Last Man Standing Group. And we get together once a year, and we have done so for 18 years. In this particular time we had together was to put the ashes of one of our friends who had died a few months back, who was a member of our group, and we put his ashes in the river pursuant to his request.
For younger passengers, the river offers new discoveries.
I haven't seen a bat nest, and it was up on a bridge near the shore, I guess. I don't know how to explain. I think my favorite part is just watching the river as we go and watching how it's flowing and all the waves that bump against the boat and stuff.
Captain Verdi has been operating boats since 1995 and has been doing river cruises on the Mississippi for 4 years.
It's fun. It's nice to be doing something that Mark Twain and a bunch of other guys did a long time ago, so it's kind of interesting that way. And so you're part of history, and we're probably the last two boats on the upper Mississippi area that are actually doing it now, with the Paradise Charters, Minneapolis Queen, and the Paradise Lady.
Even after doing the same stretch so many times, Birdie says he learns enough each week to keep coming back.
There's always something new happening. Like right now, we've got the Franklin Avenue Bridge. We'll be going underneath, and they're doing a lot of construction on that area. The bridge is getting a facelift, basically, and made safer, new bridge decking. So you look at that stuff. There's also wildlife, and the customers are always interesting. Sometimes they're a little too interesting, but it makes it kind of fun, too. So, doing that, and I just the love of boating. I've been a boater my whole life, so it's just something that I love to do and actually making money doing it. So that's what I like to do about it.
Whether it's someone taking a break from Twin Cities traffic or someone just doing their everyday job, the Mississippi River attracts people for all sorts of different reasons. For Real College Podcast, I'm Jackie Renzetti.
But if boating's not your thing, that's okay. There's plenty of other ways to get involved with nature while staying in the Twin Cities and surrounding area. Some of them can be pretty hands-on. After the rusted-patched bumblebee, an endangered bee native to the Twin Cities, was named Minnesota's state bumblebee, RCP reporter Hannah Dove decided to take a deeper look into the world of do-it-yourself beekeeping and how everyday people can do more to take care of bees in their daily lives. Here's Hannah Dove with more.
You're driving up north for the weekend just to get away from the hustle and the bustle of the city. You pass by roaming rock cliffs, evergreen forests, and maybe even fields to graze in. But instead of seeing cattle or horses, you see wooden boxes nestled among the tall grass. Why is this? This week, RCP talks to two bee specialists, Dr. Rebecca Masterman of the UMN Bee Squad and head pollinator Austin Denman of Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, to see what all the buzz about rural beekeeping is really about.
The Bee Squad is an organization supported by University of Minnesota Extension, and our goal is to not just help beekeepers, but we support the public in helping bees. We do different programming within the community that allows everybody to really play a role in supporting bee health in Minnesota and beyond.
We have like a little team here at Fond du Lac College, and I help direct everyone and teach everyone how to keep the club going along, like this team to keep thriving, because since we're a two-year college, it keeps rotating almost every year. So I help teach newcomers the skills to help keep this running.
Could you tell me the difference between rural beekeeping and urban beekeeping, if there even are any differences?
So like with rural, I feel like we have a lot more space to actually plant gardens. In urban areas, it's a lot more concrete and harder to actually bring the bees food and all that stuff.
So honeybees are able to be kept in any environment as long as there are enough flowers for them. So they can absolutely thrive in an urban environment as well as rural environments. The biggest difference between the beekeepers in urban areas versus rural areas is that most of the urban beekeepers are very small scale. So they might just have 1, 2, maybe 10 or 12 hives. But when you get out into rural communities, those areas support our commercial beekeepers that we have in Minnesota. So it's really a matter of scale. In rural areas, you will have very small beekeepers up to beekeepers who own thousands of honeybee colonies. And in the urban areas, you really do just have those smaller beekeepers.
So why are bees so big in Minnesota? Do they contribute a large portion to our rural economy? Is it because of our climate, our flora, our fauna, or just because?
It's tricky to actually measure what the economic impact is, but honey production is actually very important in Minnesota. We are usually number 6 or 7 in honey production, and those numbers can reach to a total of $14 million plus based upon honey prices and honey production. The actual pollination services in Minnesota are really limited to apples and some other small crop. Apple orchards will have pollination supported by honeybees, and the apple industry is around 18 million or so. Our commercial beekeepers own most of the bees in the United States, and several of those commercial beekeepers will bring their bees to Minnesota in the late spring, summer in order to feed them great nutritious flowers. It is a migratory business if you're a commercial beekeeper. Most of your bees will travel, and some go down to Texas. Some go to California for the almond pollination services that happen in February. Many of the commercial beekeepers are also raising honeybee queens, and they do that in southern states or in California. And so really, when you look at Minnesota, we are home to a number of commercial beekeepers. And they come to Minnesota to get their bees healthy after those bees have worked across the country doing pollination services. A lot of the money that the commercial beekeepers will make is not actually in the honey, but it's in the pollination services. It's in the production of honeybees and honeybee queens for other beekeepers to purchase.
Yeah, it's because of all the flowers, I think, that we have and like our different biomes. It like creates like this whole of array of different sources of foods that the bees can actually take.
Our honeybees love weeds, and so where some people might not like the yellow sweet clover, our honeybees love the yellow sweet clover. The apple pollination doesn't necessarily make them healthy. They were actually only pollinating the apples for a short period of time, not getting a ton of food from those apples. They're working when they're in the apple orchards, but it's the clovers and other flowers that they're feeding on through the rest of the summer that's making them nice and healthy.
So there's a lot of talk about saving the bees, but what actually are threats to bees in Minnesota?
All of our honeybees in Minnesota and the rest of the United States are under threat from a mite pest called Varroa destructor that is not just feeding on developing and adult bees, but it's also vectoring pathogens.
The mites themselves haven't evolved with our bees, so our bees haven't built resistance to them, and they've been causing viruses and causing colonies to collapse as well.
So this mite pest absolutely needs to be managed in order for the honeybees to be healthy. But there are several tools to be able to manage those mites, and if beekeepers are able to get them under control, then they're able to have healthy bees. We have a number of native bees in Minnesota and in the North America and throughout the world that have a very different lifestyle compared to honeybees. So most of them are solitary, and they live in stems or tunnels, so they're really hard to count, and they serve a very important purpose in pollinating not just fruits and vegetables, but pollinating flowers and making sure that our flowers are diverse and healthy and have great populations. And so what we're really worried about when people are saying save the bees, they might be referring to honeybees, but what we really are worried about is making sure those native bees are able to find enough food and able to thrive. They both face similar threats. They have Varroa destructor. Bees always need more flowers, and also they have pesticides. We have pesticide issues, not just in rural-ish areas, but urban areas. And those pesticides are usually, you know, cosmetic. They're not agriculture-driven. They're because people don't want weeds in their yard or are worried about Japanese beetles, things like that.
Is there anything the average person can do to help the bees?
There's actually a lot of resources online, like for what I've been using too, because when I started this, I actually knew nothing about bees. And when I started beginning to working with them, I started learning a lot. There's a lot of helpful videos on YouTube. And a good thing to do also is find a local bee club in your area and actually join them too. So bee clubs have a lot of average Joe people working with bees, and they bring some of them have been like working for like years with their bees, and so they can like give you very helpful advice. They can tell you what to do in the area you are. So like up here in Fond du Lac, where it's more, seems colder and more wintery for our bees, we actually have a moisture board that we put in winter, and that actually soaks up all the moisture and helps them avoid all that in the winter and don't get hurt.
Anybody who looks at their yard, if they want to look at their yard in a bee-friendly way, they can go to the Bee Lab website and find out how to put flowers in their yard. When you're thinking about bees, if you can put in trees, things like maple trees are going to provide a really nice early source of pollen, as well as willow. That's a great early source of pollen. And if you look at different flowers throughout the different the ongoing season, you're going to find different benefits to different flowers.
So there are like certain plants, depending on what bees you want to attract. Like for native bees, they really want native flowers. So like you would go to, there's a place, just search online, like Minnesota native flowers, and you can find like places where they sell prairie flowers and all that, that you could use to help attract native bee pollen.
Mint is a great producer of nectar for bees. And goldenrod is a great late source of nectar for bees, as well as asters. But there are so many different flowers that are going to provide food that if you go to your local garden store or your seed store, they're going to probably be able to help you tailor a plan for your area that meets your needs and the land that you want to put some flowers into.
Now let's end with some parting remarks from both of our bee specialists.
I often tell beekeepers that they should think of their colony of honeybees. You might have 40 or 50,000 honeybees in one colony, but think of them as a small, like a 15-pound dog, and you need to care for that animal. You need to make sure it has food and water. You need to make sure that it is as free from pests and disease as you can possibly manage it, and you need to make sure that it even has air. And framing it in the sense of putting it into animal husbandry is an excellent, excellent way to look at honeybees. We can't look at our native bees like that, but because we are managing honeybees, that is the absolute perfect way, in my opinion and others, that of looking at our honeybees.
I know that after last year's bee symposium, NIMBA, that's the club that works with us, they actually are starting to increase numbers greatly. It's kind of been really interesting to see that. So it's gaining a lot more like traction. So if it's not that big right now, I feel like it's going to be kind of big.
Well, there you have it. Though you might not be able to spot too many bee boxes taking over lands normally reserved for other farm animals such as cattle or sheep, rest assured that they will be in the background, buzzing along, maintaining the wondrous diversity of Minnesota's native flora and fauna. That is, if we take the steps to give a little help to our bumbling friends along the way. With RCP, this is Hannah Dove signing off.
If you'd like to do more to help take care of our native bumblebees, there's a few easy steps you can take this summer. The first is planting blooming flowers available from early spring all the way through the fall, so that native bumblebees, like the rusty-patched bumblebee, can feed on them and make honey. Another easy thing you can do to take care of our native bumblebees is to leave places for them to nest, including wood piles, piles of leaves, or other undisturbed areas of your yard. With just a few simple steps, you can do your part to help make sure that our bumblebee population continues to survive in the Twin Cities. But there's more to summer than just bees and steamboats. One classic summer activity is bicycling. There are miles and miles of bicycle trails in the Twin Cities, and if you ask me, that's one of the best parts of living here during the summer. But these bicycle trails aren't just used for recreation, and unfortunately, they aren't accessible to everyone. The world of biking can be focused on those with the money and time to invest in things like expensive racing bikes or pay for classes on bike maintenance. It's a demographic that skews white, middle class, and male. Founded and run by bikers who exist outside of this stereotype, Cycling for Change is a Twin Cities cycling organization that strives to change the culture around biking and make biking accessible to everyone by spreading knowledge and tools about bike maintenance and proper bike practice. Liv Riggins has more.
And you see how far the shifter or derailleur can push. And if it doesn't go all the way back, there's these two little screws called limit screws, low and high. They're labeled like LH. And yeah, it's really hard. After 4 years, you know, I eventually, you know, became a master at it, but you know, some people just, you know, aren't as good. Yeah, it's really hard.
That's Dijon, a youth apprentice at Cycles for Change. He and Liliana, also a youth apprentice, were showing me how to fix a broken gear shift at their St. Paul open shop. It's a busy space with bikes and bike parts covering the walls and workstations, and an old sofa barricaded behind broken wheels with a stereo playing on top of it. Staff member and bike grant coordinator Patrick Galavis explains how the workshop is set up.
The open shop is just like opening up the space back here. We have different stations. Each station has the same set of tools, everything that you would need to fix most things on a bike. And we help you learn how to fix your own bike. So you're the one hands-on wrenching while we're showing you exactly what to do. This is how it works, and you get to do this yourself, but you're not on your own. And so it's a way to have people learn how to do stuff so that they don't have to pay someone to do it, and they also know what's going on and aren't getting like ripped off by quote-unquote the bike shop people, the bike world. You know, we're trying to share that knowledge instead of like keep it and profit off of it, which is how a lot of things work in this world.
Like, someone just came in and I gave him free brake pads. He said he didn't get paid till tomorrow.
I don't have the heart just to say, oh, no. Because they're only like $2 anyways. And he just kept thanking me. And like people, they just like say thank you, I swear, like 20 times before they leave. Like they're super appreciative. And that's what we're here for.
An easy fix, like some new brake pads, can mean a lot though, and biking is your main form of transportation.
Some people do use it as a main transportation to get to and from work, from home to school, to work. Like I do, I bike all the time.
Changing the economics of the bike world so that biking is viable for everyone is a big part of what goes on at Cycles for Change. Beyond the economics, though, creating an open and welcoming culture for people in the Frogtown neighborhood is equally important. In a lot of ways, the bike shop is as much a community center as a workshop.
Trying to pick kids of color to give them a chance, you know, to be in the bike world. So we like to, like, stick with community, and it feels like a big family. Like, we're all committed to bikes, and we just want to help the community, like, whether that's giving out free parts or free bikes. Like, I feel like we're all on the same page on that. We have to joke around, so, you know, turn up music.
From what I see, I think a lot of the kids from the neighborhood really like this space and really use the space. So in the summer, you know, kids are out of school, and where do they go? They're probably outside playing around, but this is a place where they can come and get water and, like, fix their bike, meet other young kids in the neighborhood, like, have something to do that's productive. They help out sometimes, like, in the shop and learn some bike mechanics. So in that sense, I think it's really cool because really anyone can come in when we're open, and even if you're not fixing a bike, you can come and sit on the couch or, you know, tell us how your day went.
This focus on expanding what it means to be part of bike culture extends beyond the store, too. Biking, especially in the city, requires a lot of infrastructure. Bike lanes, but also roads that are smooth enough for the delicate tires of road bikes, or bridges with ramps instead of stairs. Expanding the cultural base of the bike community also means trying to expand the infrastructure for biking.
Those bikers that are more, like, that we think of, like white guys with spandex and beards or whatever, those are most of the time the people that are voicing their opinion in, like, the city level, where there's policies are being put into place, or, like, bike lanes are being talked about being put in different neighborhoods. So a lot of the times the actual bikers in the community aren't the ones that are giving input. Part of what we wanted to do is establishing ownership. Like, we tell people, hey, do you go to meetings? Like, do you want to fill out the survey? Or, like, trying to get people's opinions about what they need in their neighborhood. People need to feel like they're a biker, you know? Like, you are a biker. If you're on a bike, even if you're just going to work, just using it to the store, you don't race, you don't have biking buddies, you're still a biker in the city, so your voice should be heard. We're trying to get that mentality of, like, it's not an elitist thing, it's knowledge that you should have too.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Liv Riggins.
While biking may remain inaccessible to some, there's no denying that the Twin Cities have some of the strongest biking communities and bike infrastructure of anywhere in the nation. Compared to sprawling, car-centric cities in many other parts of the country, miles and miles of dedicated bike paths and bike boulevards make taking a summer bike ride in Minneapolis relatively easy. RCP reporter Katie Boleyn found out more by speaking to two bikers, one of whom has been biking in the Twin Cities for decades.
It's cheaper for one thing, but then there's, like, built-in exercise, and it makes my head feel way better too than, like, sitting just being pissed off in a car all the time.
My friend Kate Seymour, who is now 27, has been riding a bike for transportation since she was 19.
I just moved to Minneapolis, and I had this really cruddy little car that I would drive around, and someone had slashed my tire, and the alternator was bad, so I'd have to get a jump start. Well, my car doesn't really even work, so I just kind of started walking places and taking the bus. And then my mom called me one day, and she was like, how's your car doing? And I was like, oh, it's great, driving it every day. And she was like, oh, because I have a letter from the Minneapolis impound lot that it's actually been there for over a month. And I was like, well, I'm an idiot. And she was like, yep, and the fees are worth more than the car, so you just don't have a car anymore. And then I just started biking after that.
So you didn't want to drive anymore?
Mm-mm. Once I started biking, I was like, oh, this is way better. Because in Minneapolis, it's so easy to get from place to place. Like, you can be anywhere in, like, half an hour. It's not that much longer than if you just drove a car.
According to the city of Minneapolis, there are 92 miles of on-street bikeways and 85 miles of off-street paths.
They have really tried to make biking safer.
Peter May is almost 69 years old and is still cycling around the Twin Cities.
I ride with the Twin Cities Bicycling Club. I love to ride bicycles.
He's been riding in Minneapolis since the late 1960s, when he was a student at the University of Minnesota.
It was my means of transportation when I was in school. And I do remember wrecking a front wheel when I was admiring a young lady walking by on the sidewalk when I should have been paying attention to the road and hit a pothole.
Peter has watched Minneapolis transform from a city made for cars to a bike-friendly paradise.
They've got so many rails to trails, which are great because you get fewer street crossings with them, which is, you know, one of the biggest areas of danger for bicyclists. But they've also started putting in their safe streets and their bike boulevards, which make it easier for bicyclists to get around. They're looking at it to try and get from place A to B safely, rather than just, well, we'll just make this road a safe road, even if it doesn't go anywhere near where anybody wants to go.
Kate Zamer.
It's set up well to ride. Even if there isn't a bike lane or something, it's not like in these other huge sprawling cities where just a regular street is like four lanes. But here it's just small and it seems easy.
Everyday physical dangers that come with riding a bike. A recent study, published by the American Journal of Public Health, found that cities with bike share programs, like Minneapolis, had a 14% increase in bike-related head injuries than those cities without bike programs. Although the study has been widely criticized for its lack of identifying the cause and effect of bike-related head injuries, it still raises important concerns about bike share programs and bike safety awareness.
Have you ever had a serious injury?
I cracked my head open once on my way to buy a helmet because I was being an idiot. So that one was my fault. I'll take responsibility for that. I did get hit one time, that wasn't my fault, but managed to come out of it pretty okay. Just some banged up and broken bike.
And Peter is currently injured from a bike-related incident.
My right arm went out, went over the railing, and came down full force on my shoulder. Consequently, that caused a fracture of the scapula, and so I'm hung up here for, you know, 4, 6, 8 weeks, I don't know.
Bike-related injuries seem inevitable, sort of like a modern-day battle wound for the urban, eco-friendly commuter. But the risk of road rash or a broken limb won't stop bikers like Kate from paying attention to the bigger picture.
Do you feel like you're making a difference?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think sometimes it might seem a little bit daunting to think like, oh, yep, I am making a difference because I am riding my bike. But yeah, I think that it does. I think everybody who, every time someone doesn't drive a car, it does make a difference in some way or another.
Any complaints?
No, I don't know. I'm sure that there's, like, a bunch of things that you could be like, oh, boy, I wish that they would do this and this, but really, like, I just like to bike, and the fact that I can do that here makes me super happy, so I don't want to complain too much about that.
Well, that's all for RCP this week. Thanks, as always, to everyone who helped out with this episode, Jackie Renzetti, Hannah Dove, Liv Riggins, and Katie Boleyn. Real College Podcast is produced by Liv Riggins, Lizzie Ritchie, Tosin Fasimo, and me, Ben Hallam. Nathan Fervoy is our host and managing editor. You can find Real College Podcast online at radiok.org or on iTunes, Spotify, or any place podcasts are found.